I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
This is Barry Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. So where are we in the story? Election Day, 1948, had started with hope for the black community, but their choice for governor, Melvin Thompson, had lost. And the heir apparent to the Talmadge dynasty, still echoing his father's white supremacy, Herman Talmadge, would soon take office. And for some of the black men who did vote, despite warnings, there were dire consequences. John Harris, the handyman, returned home to find that his wife had nailed up the house with the kids inside. He joined them, fearful of what might happen next. Dover Carter, head of the NAACP, had been stopped on a winding road and severely beaten by two white men. And his good friend, Isaiah Nixon, the farmer, had been shot three times, was critically injured, and was fighting for his life at a hospital in Dublin, Georgia. Dover Carter goes there, sees Nixon, and hears about his terrifying day. Now, Dover Carter is faced with a decision. Head back home, back to his farm and his family near Alston, or tell authorities what he's heard. But what authority would he tell? Dover Carter remained a man on a mission, but now, having seen Isaiah Nixon struggling to live, his mission had changed dramatically. Leaving Claxton Hospital, Dover Carter made a critical decision. He headed north, straight to Atlanta. And there he went to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. Now, by doing this, Dover Carter is not just leaving his family for a while. He's taken a major risk. He's been warned not to talk about his beating, but knowing what he now knows about Isaiah Nixon, he decides that he must. So he's at the FBI, where he sits with a special agent and begins talking and telling. His conversations with the FBI, well, they left a large paper trail, which gives a lot of detail, especially in regard to his severe beating on that winding road. Dover Carter's statement is so vivid that we've asked an actor to read some passages from it.
My name is Dover Carter. I live on a farm outside of Ailey, Georgia. On September 8, 1948, I drove to Austin.
Up to now, what we've told you about Dover Carter's beating comes from his family members. But we found a lot of documents the family had never seen. We've got FBI interviews with Dover Carter, a deposition, stacks of memos, and other papers from the NAACP, including letters he wrote, letters he received, in all, more than 500 pages. In a couple of instances, for clarity, we've edited Dover Carter's statement and his story.
On September 8, 1948, I drove to Austin to vote in the Georgia Democratic primary.
On the morning of that election day, you may recall, Dover Carter and his wife nearly had a head-on collision. That's because the sheriff-elect, Claude Sharp, had swerved his light blue Ford into their lane several times. To avoid an accident, Dover Carter had to take evasive action.
I pulled my car onto the shoulder and kept going. And when I arrived at the polls, Mr. Sharp also arrived immediately afterward.
Dover Carter was at the polling place so that his wife could vote. And the record shows he'd spend the day shuttling black voters to and from the polls.
The poll manager, Mr. Marvin McBride,
McBride, a white man, who was quietly organizing black voters to get them to the polls. He was rounding up those votes for Governor Melvin Thompson, that is, against Herman Talmadge.
Mr. Marvin McBride gave me a list of all the registered colored that had not voted and requested me to get them to the polls as quickly as possible.
And so that's what he did. Now, we're not sure how many people he got to the polls on Election Day, but as the head of the NAACP in Montgomery County, we can guess it was as many as he could possibly get there. Then, later in the day, Dover Carter was driving on that winding road. He was driving a woman and her son away from the polls after she had voted. That's when two white men, Johnny Johnson and his brother-in-law, Thomas Wilson, accelerated past Dover Carter's truck and blocked the road in front of him. The men got out of their car and approached.
Thomas Wilson continued to advance toward me with his gun pointed on me until he was close enough to point the gun through my right car door to my side. He demanded that I get out of the car, stating that they were going to kill me.
Seeing this, the passengers in his truck quickly ran off. Johnny Johnson yanked Dover Carter's door open and began striking him. It was a two-fisted assault, and with each blow, Dover Carter noticed something. Johnny Johnson was holding a weapon in each hand.
Mr. Johnny Johnson continued to beat me with a piece of iron fastened to his arm and with fist knucks.
Fist knucks, you know, brass knuckles.
As they spoke to me, I could not answer both of them at the same time because Mr. Johnny Johnson was continuing to beat me as fast as he could with both hands until he stopped to arrest a moment. Then he began attacking me again. He continued to beat me until my head was bloody and my hands were paralyzed.
And, according to Dover Carter's statement to the FBI, a car passed during this incident. A light blue Ford, driven by Sheriff-elect Claude Sharp.
At this time, I noted a blue Ford pass, and Mr. Claude Sharp was driving. Mr. Johnny Johnson stopped long enough to see who was passing and laughed at Mr. Claude Sharp.
Did you hear that? Johnny Johnson, while beating Dover Carter, looks up to see who was passing by. And he sees Claude Sharp, and then he laughs at Claude Sharp. So picture this, the two men, that's the soon-to-be sheriff, Claude Sharp, and the man who's beating Dover Carter, Johnny Johnson, are locking eyes with each other, and then let's listen to what happens next.
And Mr. Sharp laughed back. And then Mr. Johnson continued beating me.
That beating continued for about 25 minutes. Eventually, the beating would stop.
They demanded that I turn my truck around, go home, and not haul any more people to the polls, nor be caught at the polls anymore. And they'd better not hear me say anything about this.
And so here I got to pause to point out one really important fact. Had Dover Carter abided by this warning, had he just gone home and shut up, we wouldn't know this story. Not just this incident on the road, we wouldn't know about the warning that Claude Sharp gave John Harris. We wouldn't know the story of the shooting of Isaiah Nixon. All of that would have been lost to history. So it's fair to say that this entire podcast was built on the foundation of Dover Carter's courage to tell his stories to federal authorities. After the beating, Dover Carter went home, and then he went to a doctor and was treated for his severe injuries. And the one thing he knew is that he better remain scarce. Knowing that his family was being taken care of in Austin, he stayed in Atlanta for a while.
The reason I came to Atlanta was that I feared another attempt might have been made on my life.
All of this, everything he says, goes into the FBI memos. And soon, the memos will be on their way to the FBI office in Savannah and to the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dover Carter also shares his stories with the largest black newspaper in the South, the Atlanta Daily World. Back in the Claxton Hospital, on September 10th, Isaiah Nixon died. And with that, Daisy Davis lost her only child. Sally Nixon lost her husband, and 6 children lost their father. And among those children was one who had been born only 15 days earlier, a son, and they had named him Isaiah Nixon Jr. The death of Isaiah Nixon makes the charges against Jim A. and Johnny Johnson even more serious. This is not just a shooting. It's a killing. And as far as the current sheriff is concerned, Sheriff R. M. McCrimmon, this is murder. Now keep in mind that Sheriff McCrimmon is only in office for a couple of more weeks. Claude Sharp, who had defeated him a few weeks earlier in the election for sheriff, will soon take his place. But since Sheriff McCrimmon still has the power to act, he does, and he arrests the 2 Johnson brothers. And then he does something else. He makes an important declaration. He says that Isaiah Nixon was shot because he had voted. Now that declaration from a white sheriff in South Georgia at a time like that was instant news. The Associated Press picked it up, released it around the country, and a brief story even made it into the New York Times. But what about Dover Carter? The sheriff made no arrests on that assault, even though Johnny Johnson and Thomas Wilson wouldn't deny that they'd beaten him. Instead, they'd claimed that Dover Carter tried to provoke them, that he'd accelerated and nearly crashed into the back of their car. And so these men were going to claim self-defense. So let's stay on this for a second. The 2 white men, Johnny Johnson and Thomas Wilson, are saying that Dover Carter, a quiet, prayerful man, a father of 10 children, with a woman and her son in his truck, Dover Carter, who's trying to go unnoticed all day as he shuttles voters to the polls. Dover Carter, who as head of the NAACP has been building to this day, decided to risk it all by provoking these 2 armed white men? But wait, what about Sheriff-elect Claude Sharp? You may remember that Dover Carter said he and his wife were nearly run off the road by him. These same FBI documents include a statement from Claude Sharp. It reads, "At no time during the day did I see Dover Carter driving his car, and I did not at any time try to run him off of the road." Well, what about the part of the story that we just heard, that Claude Sharp drove by and saw the white men beating Dover Carter and laughed? Claude Sharp would claim he wasn't even on that road that day. He was busy at the voting polls and didn't have time to leave. He also said he wasn't the sheriff at the time. Essentially, he didn't have the authority to intervene. But, he added, "I did not pass by the place where the fight was taking place. If I had passed, I would have stopped to see what was going on." So I want to go back to Dover Carter's conversation in Atlanta with the FBI agent. This is really important. As Carter is telling the story of what's happened to him and to Isaiah Nixon, what's the agent listening for? It's simple. A reason to bring federal charges. Back then, it really wouldn't have been much of a federal case just because Isaiah Nixon and Dover Carter were attacked for voting. But the good possibility that the morning attack on Dover Carter and the afternoon shooting of Isaiah Nixon might be part of a conspiracy to deny them their votes, their civil rights, now that was a different matter, because conspiracy would be a federal crime. So, after taking Dover Carter's statement, the FBI agent drafts a memo, and he sends it by telex to the nation's top cop, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. The agent writes that the beating and the shooting, quote, appear to be related and possibly part of an overall conspiracy. Those magic words, part of an overall conspiracy, land on Hoover's desk. Now, J. Edgar Hoover is well known, even in 1948, for believing that civil rights attacks belong with state and local prosecutors, not with the feds. Decisions over what crimes to prosecute and which ones to leave alone reside with his boss, the Attorney General. But Hoover can influence those decisions. And he does. He does so by sending a memo up the chain of command at the Justice Department, but with one glaring omission. He drops that magic word, conspiracy. Instead, Hoover writes to an assistant attorney general, "You may desire to consider these complaints together." And then he closes by saying, "No investigation is contemplated unless requested by you." One person deeply concerned about the Election Day assaults was Thurgood Marshall, special counsel to the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. This was nearly 20 years before he'd take a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. So Thurgood Marshall sent a telegram straight to the governor of Georgia, Melvin Thompson, pushing him to do all he could to prosecute the men who beat Dover Carter and shot Isaiah Nixon on Election Day. "Use your full authority," he wrote. "Push vigorous prosecution. This type of intimidation, if permitted to go unpunished, will make our Constitution a farce." Now, Governor Melvin Thompson, who was still in office for just a few weeks more and would soon be replaced by Herman Talmadge, responded. Melvin Thompson assured Thurgood Marshall that the Nixon killing is being pushed vigorously by the prosecuting authorities. And then the governor added something, and this is something Melvin Thompson didn't really have to say, but he said it. "You may be assured of my willingness to do everything I can, as long as I am chief executive, to see that those violating the law are brought to justice." Meanwhile, word that a black farmer in a small Georgia town had been killed, that might not make national news. But when the sheriff announced that Isaiah Nixon was killed for voting, that was different, and it resonated in the newsroom of a weekly newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier. The Courier was the most widely circulated black newspaper in America. That year, 1948, its circulation hit an astonishing 358,000 copies per week. It traveled from Pittsburgh by the busload to black communities in every city, town, and crossroads in the South. So the Pittsburgh Courier dispatched a reporter to Allston, Georgia, to investigate. His name, Alexander Rivera.
"Hello?"
As a black reporter covering race news during those days in the South, Alexander Rivera had accumulated a lot of fascinating stories. The Isaiah Nixon story, for one. In an interview more than 50 years later, Rivera told the story of that trip. He was seated at his office desk.
"Something happened that never happened before in my whole life. Something told me, I don't know what the something was, to go dressed as a chauffeur."
Rivera figured that anyone who saw him dressed as a chauffeur would think that he worked for someone important.
"It was easier traveling."
Easier traveling. He drove a conspicuous Buick Roadmaster. And once he arrived in Allston, he set out to find the home of Isaiah Nixon. He turned to a local man to ask for directions. Something seemed wrong, so Alexander Rivera approached the man cautiously.
"Let me ask you something. You nervous?" "Yeah." I asked him, I said, "Did you know Isaiah Nixon?" He starts sweeping real fast. "Said, yeah, I know him, yeah." I said, "You know where it is?" He said, "Yeah."
So Rivera offered him $5, the equivalent of about $50 today, by the way. And this local man agreed to take Rivera out to the Nixon farmhouse.
"And I photographed the family and the kids, interviewed the wife."
The story of the killing of Isaiah Nixon would soon make its way to hundreds of thousands of Pittsburgh Courier readers. At this point, I gotta stress that there were very few eyewitnesses to the shooting of Isaiah Nixon. There's his daughter, Dorothy, of course. But there's another, and I sat with her and some of her family members at a retirement home.
Look at them two, don't they look like twins?
She's petite, she has an easy smile, she's 93 years old, and it's Isaiah Nixon's wife, Sally Nixon.
It's a privilege to meet all of you.
At the time of Isaiah Nixon's death, he was 28 and Sally was 25. I was so happy to hear that she was still alive and so grateful for the opportunity to meet with her. So I came with a lot of questions.
And after you met him, was it long before you decided to get married or?
No.
No? He was ready? It sounds like you were, too.
He was a few years older than I was.
Right.
As we talk, Sally is totally delightful. And she smiles as she tells me that her late husband was a nice enough fellow. He wasn't that tall. He was maybe 5'7".
Okay.
And handsome.
Yeah, he was handsome. I've seen the picture.
But he was also cautious on voting day in 1948. And he wouldn't let her go to the polls.
I went with him everywhere he go. But that day, he wouldn't let me go. He didn't know whether he was going to make it back to the house or not.
For now, she's happy to reflect and reminisce. We discuss an old photo of her husband. Well, actually, it's the only photo of her husband. I tell her that I really like that hat that he's wearing.
Yeah, just bought the hat, and I buried him in the suit, and I sold Ked's shoes back to the store.
He had one suit, and she sold his shoes back to the store. We'll talk again with Isaiah Nixon's wife, Sally, and his daughter, Dorothy, and we'll find out what happened now that two men had been arrested for killing Isaiah Nixon. There are some powerful stories coming up. I hope you'll stay with us. This is Buried Truths.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now to the funeral of Isaiah Nixon. It took place at the Flipper New Hope AME Church in Uvalde, Georgia. The entire Nixon family was there, and that includes Isaiah Nixon's 6-year-old daughter, Dorothy, in a little white dress.
I remember the funeral. I don't remember leaving the house or nothing like that. I just remember getting to the church. I was sitting on the side because I didn't want to sit up there where my sisters and everybody was, so they let me do it. I remember every time my older sister looked at the casket and my daddy, she would faint. She just kept fainting over and over. I remember that. I don't remember crying. I was just sitting there like, numb, and even then angry, trying to understand why would somebody kill my daddy, you know? And he was good, so why would they shoot him like that? I didn't understand anything about voting and, you know, black-white situations and that kind of thing. I just knew it was my daddy, and I didn't understand. I didn't want to be up there looking, and so I just sat in the corner. And I did a lot of corner sitting for years, really. And I was very angry.
Sitting in the corner, not sitting with her family at the funeral. Sitting off to the side, this became Dorothy's routine behavior. Her response to just about everything was to go hide and be alone.
From the day that they shot him, the same afternoon and night, they'd have to get me from behind the house and bring me in. Days that followed, I'd be under the house or behind the house. If somebody came up, I'd run and I'd hide. As I was growing up, you know, I was very much alert and knew, you know, I wasn't mentally disturbed, but because I stayed to myself. They called me weird, but I wasn't as weird as they thought. I just could not trust people. I didn't want to be around people.
And even after the funeral, the pain and the anger of all she'd seen just would not end. And the nightmares would begin.
I saw it over and over again. One of the things that I saw all the time was hiding behind the house, just shaking, which it did happen. So I had nightmares about being behind the house. And that was the central theme most of the time, was hiding behind the house when people came.
The funeral of Isaiah Nixon was well attended. And afterward, the family rode from the church and onto a dirt road that went on and on to the cemetery, deep in the woods of Montgomery County. This is not one of those sprawling cemeteries spread over rolling hills. It's a clearing in the woods. And from just about anywhere you stand, you can see every gravesite and every headstone. And it was here, in mid-September 1948, that Isaiah Nixon was buried. As Isaiah Nixon is being mourned and buried, state prosecutors are moving forward with the murder case against the Johnson brothers. Meanwhile, attorneys with the FBI and the Justice Department in Washington, Atlanta, and Savannah, they're not quite sure what to do. They've got two incidents, the Dover Carter beating and the Isaiah Nixon killing, with an overlap of family members, and they're being told out of Washington this isn't a conspiracy. So how do they get a foothold on this case? In Washington, lawyers in the Justice Department know that any case that they bring in rural Georgia might backfire. And this is actual words from a federal attorney, that it might inflame local sentiment and undermine the state's murder case. So the feds decide to lay low and let the state go first. And if needed, the feds can get involved later. The trial for the murder of Isaiah Nixon, the state versus Jim A. Johnson and Johnny Johnson, took place on November 4th, 1948, less than 2 months after his death. Now, we've searched and found no record of the court proceeding. We've got copies of the indictment. We've got the handwritten names of those in the jury pool, those selected for the jury. Yes, all white, all men, none of whom we could find still alive. But there are no records of the proceedings, no court reporter's notes, no transcript. Now, I should add that I always remain hopeful that whoever was the court reporter at the trial and took precise notes or maybe even recorded it, put the tapes or the notes in a closet or an attic that will someday be discovered and reveal what was said in the courtroom. Now remember, we have been able to pull together a few hundred pages, some records that provide a fairly authoritative account of what happened. But before we get to the trial, let's have a quick recap as to what happened the day the Johnson brothers showed up at the Nixon farm. Jim A. and Johnny Johnson asked Isaiah Nixon how he voted. And when he told them that he voted for Melvin Thompson, that's when they insisted that he go for a ride with them. Now, I've read all this in the documents, but I really want to hear this story from Sally Nixon. So I asked for her account of what she saw that day.
He said, "No, I'm not going with you, Jim A. He was a white man. Oh, he just loved my family to death, this Jim A. what shot him." And
now, what does she mean by that, that Jim A. Johnson loved Isaiah Nixon, her husband? Well, as it turns out, and this is sort of an old South cultural fact, that black and white could grow up together, that Jim A. Johnson and Isaiah Nixon grew up as kids, played with each other as kids. Jim A. Johnson even had dinner inside the Nixon home. So on this day, Sally Nixon is recalling that time, that period, that atmosphere for us. And she remembers what Jim A. said next.
Come on, go with us. He said, no, I'm not going with you. Well, we want to just talk with you about what happened today. He said, ain't nothing happened, I just voted.
Just voted.
That's all. Well, if he's not going with his best friend, shoot him. Bam, bam, bam. He voted because black people had never voted before.
Voted because black people had never voted before.
He said, no, I ain't going with you. Well, you voted. He said, yeah, I did that for my children.
Did that for my children.
Got them sitting right in front there.
Motioning to her daughter, Dorothy.
She said, Jimmy, why you shoot our daddy? And they ran.
Jim A. and Johnny Johnson would say that they'd come to Isaiah Nixon's farmhouse just to offer him a job. That's all. They were there to do him a favor and give him some work. And then, get this, they said Isaiah Nixon pulled a knife on them. That's right. At their trial, they were going to claim self-defense. Now, you've heard that alibi before in this episode, right? Remember the guys who beat up Dover Carter at gunpoint? They, too, claimed self-defense, saying that he nearly ran his truck into the car just to provoke them. And now, one of those same men, Johnny Johnson, along with his brother Jim A. Johnson, are walking into court saying they were threatened a second time on the same day by another black man, Isaiah Nixon. Self-defense. Let's discuss this more. You know, I started off this podcast walking on the Nixon farm where all this took place, asking a question. Who were we? As a people, who were we that we allowed this to happen? Well, here's who we were. In trial after trial, courtroom after courtroom across the South, whites accused of killing blacks could almost absolutely, without fail, win their freedom just by saying they acted in self-defense. It was as if white defendants, who were almost certain to face all-white, all-male juries, had a secret password that opened the door to freedom every time. But how and why did it work so automatically for white people? Why was this password, self-defense, a surefire path to freedom? Because, and we white people in the South know this, because after decades of racist demagoguery, of myths about the primitive criminal behavior of black people, myths written into textbooks, into sermons, into racist jokes, into stories, even into bedtime stories, well, it didn't take a whole lot to convince jurors that even a good man like Isaiah Nixon, even if he was being offered a job, would suddenly revert to some completely primal behavior and pull out a knife? I had mentioned in an earlier episode a story of a World War II vet, Maceo Snipes, who was shot and killed after he was the only black man to vote in Taylor County in 1946. Now, the man who killed him claimed he'd gone to see Snipes merely to collect a $10 debt, and that Snipes had pulled a knife. So he had to shoot him three times. Self-defense. Of course, it worked. You know, when word reached Atlanta that the Johnson brothers were claiming self-defense, it was just too much for the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Ralph McGill. At the time, the newspaper was the largest in the Southeast, and in his column, in which he invoked the killing of Maceo Snipes, McGill wrote these words, "That has a familiar ring. We have heard it when a prisoner was killed in his cell. We heard it 2 years ago when a Negro was called to his door and shot after voting in self-defense." Then Ralph McGill directly addressed the Johnson's alibi. "A man doesn't arm himself with a pistol when he goes to seek a hired hand." Now that sounds logical. Still, we had to ask someone who saw it, Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy. I asked her about the Johnson brothers' alibi and about what she saw that day her father was shot.
You know, there's different stories as to whether your dad had a gun or a knife that they would later
make
up this thing.
Oh, he didn't. He came because he was in the back where my mother was. And he came out. He had nothing in his hand. He knew better than that.
You've heard me suggest that the bombastic speeches of political leaders like the Talmadges provoked some whites to act out against blacks. These political leaders used heated language spiced with a lot of code words to try to appeal to the nativist instincts of the white supremacist population. And so I'd like you to listen one more time to this clip of Herman Talmadge on the campaign trail. Listen for the direct racial appeal, the part about traditions, about principles, about birthright.
The other candidates for governor are opposed to a white primary. They know that the loss of the white primary will destroy our southern traditions and principles, yet these self-seeking politicians would sell out their birthright that our grandfathers fought for a few votes.
Well, that rhetoric that politicians use to push whites into a state of fear by appealing to their birthright, to their traditions, to their heritage. Well, those code words worked their way into courtrooms in defense of the Johnson brothers and scores of others like them. Back to the trial of the Johnson brothers. The prosecution had lined up 8 witnesses, including Isaiah Nixon's wife, Sally, his mother, Daisy Davis, 2 family friends who had been at the farm and witnessed the shooting, and the sheriff who had said the Johnsons killed Nixon because he voted. Now, there's no indication in available court records who, if anyone, testified for the defense. Now, get this. Just days before the trial, the prosecutor, who was going to present evidence against the Johnson brothers, had to be replaced. He was sick. So the judge in the case, Esco Graham, had to quickly pick a substitute prosecutor. So he selected a local attorney named N.G. Reeves, Jr. Of course, this only gave Reeves very limited time to prepare. Only 3 days. We know little about the testimony that unfolded at the trial. We know all the prosecution witnesses were not called to testify. We know that Sally Nixon, when she took the stand, was on it for only 15 minutes. We know that the murder trial took about 2 hours and jury deliberation took another 2. And we know, and this is surprising, that Judge Esco Graham would later say that he didn't remember the issue of voting ever coming up at the trial. And here was the verdict. Jim Atlas Johnson, he's the man who shot Isaiah Nixon, not guilty. As for his brother Johnny Johnson, a lesser known legal term was used, nol pros, Latin for we shall no longer prosecute. In other words, the entire case was over. Back in the retirement home with Sally Nixon, she knows everything I've just told you. She lived it. But one thing that still sticks with me is the nature of childhood friendships at that time and in that place. Now, I grew up in the South, and I saw this. I saw black and white being friendly on the streets, but I had to ask her about that relationship between Jim A. Johnson and Isaiah Nixon.
It's still hard to understand why 2 men who thought of themselves as friends would have killed Isaiah Nixon for voting.
It's hard for you to understand, because you're not like that. We just know it wasn't hard for us to understand, because we know what kind of people they were. They had 2 faces. You know what that means?
Tell me.
A good face and a another face.
For the Nixon family, the shooting, the death, the verdict, it just changed their world. But stay with us, because things do get better for them. On the next episode, I'll tell you how the Nixon family moves on, how they get support from across the country, how they move into a new home designed by a famous architect, and how Sally Nixon ends up on a popular TV show. This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
Hank Klibanoff is a former reporter, editor, and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. Buried Truths is produced by David Bereswain and Kate Sweeney, edited by John Haas. The executive producer is Christine Dempsey. Please subscribe to the show. And if you have a moment, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear what you think, and your review will help others find the show. If you have any information related to this case, you can write or send a voice memo to stories@buriedtruths.org. You can follow us on social media at Buried Truths Podcast, where you'll find photographs and documents related to the case. We appreciate the help we got today from the Southern Oral History Project at the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina. They provided that interview with Alexander M. Rivera. We had help on this episode from the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Case class that Hank Klibanoff teaches, and thanks to Professor Brett Gadsden, who helped create and teach the course. Special thanks to two past students who have stayed close to this project, Ellie Studdard and Lucy Baker. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence for their support. And finally, thanks to the actor David Atkins, who played the voice of Dover Carter. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.